Larry, let's get started with the latest information coming out of the Middle East. What's going on right now and what the Biden administration is doing to avoid this conflict between Iran and Israel?
Well, so far the prediction that Iran was going to start bombing by Monday turns out to be wrong because it is, by my calculation, 7 p.m. in Tehran. In another 5 hours, it will be Tuesday morning. So that prediction obviously is wrong. There's and then Israel's out saying that regardless of whether Iran attacks in retaliation for what Israel did the other day, or if Iran doesn't, either way, Israel needs to attack Iran. Okay, so. You know, it doesn't matter what Iran does, because Iran is within the Israeli theology, the ultimate evil, Satan incarnate. You know, the Israelis like to ignore the fact that they were in bed with Iran in the early days with the Ayatollah Khomeini back in the 1980s, because then they feared Iraq more than they feared Iran, and they didn't mind selling weapons to Iran back in the day. So Iran has become the favorite, you know, sort of enemy number three for the West. Number one is China or Russia, depending on which country you are. United States is saying, hey, it's both China and Russia. But then, you know, I guess coming in third place would be Iran. Or is it North Korea? But, you know, the top four enemies that keep the defense industry going are Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. I think the fact that former Defense Minister Shoigu of Russia, who is now sort of the personal envoy for President Putin handling defense national security matters, is meeting in Tehran. I guess he arrived yesterday. They're probably talking minimal on intelligence sharing, how they're going to share intelligence, providing new weapon systems. You know, Putin will make good on his promise where he warned the United States and the West that if, you know, you keep supplying Ukraine, we can go out and supply people that you find loathsome and abhorrent. Plus, let's not forget that Iran has been conducting military exercises with Russia and China for now 5 years, at least 5 years. And it probably goes back even to 6 years. So, you know, this this is a very dangerous situation. I'm sure Shoigu is probably trying to give Iran some assurances as well, that as long as, you know, trying to keep Iran from doing something foolish. Because you did have a member of the Iranian parliament say, yeah, we got nukes now, we're going to use them. It's like, whoa. Everybody calm down. Calm down. Israel certainly thinking about using it. So, I mean, these people got Armageddon on the mind.
The problem is what Iranian can do in order to avoid any sort of escalation in the future, because as long we are witnessing the tensions between Iran and Israel, at the same time they're attacking, they're bombing Gazans and killing Gazans. It's unbelievable what's going on right now.
Yeah, you know, when you look back on the different provocations that have taken place against Iran over the last 12, 14 years. And what I'm talking about are the assassinations of the various nuclear scientists. The fact that the United States stopped, we took the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK, M-E-K, off of the terrorist list. They're terrorists. Then we said, no, you're no longer terrorists. You're our buddies. Yeah, we're friends. And so we took them off the terrorist list, started arming them and training them, and then sending them back in to carry out terrorist attacks against Iran. Wait. I thought Iran was a state sponsor of terrorism. You mean the United States is funding a terrorist group that's carrying out terrorist attacks? Oh, my God. How could that be? I'm shocked. Glad I'm sitting down. You know, so, you know, Iran's shown, I think, remarkable restraint. And the primary reason the United States and most of the West says, oh, it's a terrorism sponsor, is because Iran helps Hamas and Hezbollah. And as we've demonstrated before, calling Hamas a major international terrorist group is a joke. What they are is they're fighting what they view as Israeli occupiers. And you know, the Israelis don't like it. And they, you know, they can label them as terrorists if they want, but it's not like Hamas has some judicial process they can go through, that they could file a lawsuit and go stand before a judge and get a fair judgment. You know, what their only choice is either surrender, submit, or fight. And so by choosing to fight in those circumstances, they get labeled as a terrorist group. Same for Hezbollah. And then the, you know, compounding matters is the fact that they've got a religious motivation. You know, it's all viewed as part of their relationship with Allah.
Do you feel any sort of plan on the part of Washington right now? Because they're sending Arab countries to Iran. They're trying to communicate with Iran. They're talking with Chinese to convince Iranians not to do that. But at the end of the day, what would be their plan for the future of Middle East? Because the way that Israel is doing this and just attacking each and every country in that region is not sustainable, is not logical.
Yeah, I've always told you that's your problem. You are always obsessed with logic and rational thought. Hey, brother, this is not about being logical and rational. This is at a deep, deep emotional level. And part of it is tied up in religious fervor. But the, you know, the irony is people like Netanyahu, he's not a religious Jew at all. You know, he just plays at one. He's not like the Hasidic Jews that are, you know, actually refuse military service because they think that Israel is, that it shouldn't exist yet, that it's a violation of the prophets, of the prophets. But this is, you always got to say, if I'm going to use military force, what's my end objective? I want to end the threat. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, the only way you're going to end this threat is you're going to have to kill every single Arab and Muslim in the world. Not realistic. That threat's not going to go away. So therefore, to me, in the rational mind, and I'll join you with on the logic train, you got to sit back and say, what can we do otherwise? What are some other strategies and approaches we can take that would you know, bring us a lasting peace where we can at least coexist with these people without them trying to kill us? Does that mean Israel has to give some things up? Yeah, probably. Does that mean Israel's willing to give those up? Absolutely not. You know, the heart of a solution will start with making sure that the people in the West Bank, the Palestinians, that is their territory. And maybe, you know, maybe it means you come up with a solution where the West Bank goes entirely to the Palestinians and Israel gets Gaza. You know, I'm not advocating that. I'm just offering that as, you know, something that might be part of that kind of deal. Now, is that something that I don't think the Israelis would accept that at all. And I'm not sure the Palestinians would accept that at all. And so it just, you know, this is going to be settled with blood. And a lot more people are going to die, I'm afraid.
Yeah, the other strange thing, Larry, that has happened was Jordan trying to communicate with Iran on behalf of the United States. But the question is, how is the relationship between Iran and Jordan, and why the United States decided to go in that direction?
Yeah, I'm not sure they celebrate Eid together. So, you know, Jordan, Jordan really has, I think, by Iran is viewed as a tool of the West. And in fact, it is in many regards. It's an enabler of the United States and its policies to, you know, we dress up our policies if we're fighting radical Islam, and we lump Iran in with radical Islam. And Iran is nothing of the sort, at least in my view. It's not a secular society by any stretch. It is, you know, it's a religious society, but you know, that's been the choice of the Iranian people, for them to figure it out. But the problem is, the United States is always trying to figure out what everybody else needs to be doing, should be doing. We're going to tell them what to do, and all it's done is brought a lot of death and injury and heartache around the world.
Larry, what has the United States done so far in the Middle East to defend Israel? What do we know from the weapons, everything that they're sent there?
So they've got, there's a marine expeditionary unit, MEU, that is en route. Apparently, that unit was set in motion before Israel carried out the assassination in Tehran. And so that tells me that the United States was forewarned what Israel is going to do. That's number one. They got 4,000 Marines. Their job really would be for evacuating people. If the airports are closed and there are people wanting to get out, the only way they can get out will be on ship. So the Marines would ferry them out to ships, and then the ships would take them to a port of safety. You've got that. Then you've got a carrier task force group. I think it's the Roosevelt it was in the Persian Gulf. It's pulled out of the Persian Gulf into the Arabian Sea. So it could go two ways. It could either stay off the coast of Iran and try to keep the Strait of Hormuz open, or could sail over towards the Red Sea and provide some more target practice for the Houthis, you know, because they've already driven out one aircraft carrier. But on top of that, then the United States has been, and the Brits have been, flying in combat aircraft. I guess these are being positioned for, because they expect the Iranians to launch another combination drone, cruise missile, a ballistic missile attack, and that we'll use those planes again as a part of the air defense system to shoot those down. But it also could mean that the West is preparing to launch an attack on Israel, on Iran, which I think would be just absolutely insane.
We thought that Egypt going to be together with Jordan helping Israel. It doesn't seem to be that way. Egypt just saying that they're not going to help Israel.
Well, they told Iran, they sent that message. We'll see if they meant it or not. You know, talk's cheap. You know, when you got people like the Egyptians and the Turks, you know, with Erdogan in Turkey, he talks a good game too. Doesn't deliver. Really, the only ones who have been stepped up to the plate to try to fight back and defend the Palestinians are the Houthis in Yemen. That's it. Everybody else is, you know, lots of happy talk.
Yeah, they brought down a drone from the
the Predator, the Reaper, MQ-9 Reaper. What's their? I think it's the sixth or seventh one they've shot down, and those go for about $30 million, $40 million a pop. So that's a pretty expensive drone.
And Larry, the other thing right now in the Middle East would be how these governments, Arab governments, are behaving as time goes by in this conflict between Iran and Israel. Are they trying to bring tensions down? Are they trying to pick sides? How do you think?
Some of the countries have intervened, tried to make interventions with Iran. say, oh, hey, calm down. Don't do this. And Iran basically said, screw you. We're going to take care of ourselves. So Iran this time is reportedly rejecting these offers to try to intercede, to try to get him to, stay cool and don't respond. They want to keep giving Israel a pass. And that was what was clear last Friday, or last week, I guess, when the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations made his presentation at the Security Council. And he basically said, look, you got this rules-based international order. That's what this is supposed to do. We've come to you repeatedly. And the Palestinians have come to you repeatedly. And you should have taken action, but you didn't. You blocked it. The United States blocked it. The Brits blocked it. So now we're coming. We've been attacked again. And we want you to do something about Israel. And if you don't do it, we'll take care of it. That's simple. Well, the UN's not going to do anything. And that's why, I think overall what we're looking at is really the end of the United Nations as a credible organization, because they really can't, they can't stop anything. And so I think what we're going to see emerge will be something out of BRICS, where, the political arm of BRICS will be something akin to a United Nations for the Global South, where the countries of the Global South that are the most the largest in terms of population and in terms of natural resources will actually get this, they get a seat at the Security Council where they get to, have veto power. Because right now, basically, the UN Security Council is under the control of most of the European colonial empire. And I include America in that. So you got the French, the Brits, United States. France and Britain have no business being on the Security Council. They ought to be, they're going to have a seat for Europe, have a seat for Europe. And then France and Britain can fight over it, maybe Germany, maybe Italy, but Europe gets one seat. Or maybe they get two seats. Africa, two seats. Or three seats, because you've got large countries like Egypt and Nigeria, I guess, is the largest of the countries, South Africa. So, when you go across the board, here's Iran saying, you got this UN that doesn't work, so we're going to take care of it. We'll protect ourselves. That's what's coming down the pike.
Yeah. Larry, the other thing was that the Israeli government was saying that if we perceive that Iran is going to attack, is about to attack us, we're going to attack first.
Yeah.
And in your opinion, is that possible for the Biden administration to go with that plan on the part of the Netanyahu administration? Because that's a suicide.
Yeah, well, Biden doesn't know what's going on, okay? So if you tell him, he'll forget it. He won't remember it tomorrow. But the Jake Sullivans, the Anthony Blinkens, they're playing a very dangerous game. And, this thing can be stopped in its tracks. And I think we talked about this the last time I was on. The United States and Turkey have the power to bring an end to it. United States and just tell Israel, this is going to stop. It's going to stop now. You're not getting another bullet, another piece of ammunition, nothing from us, no money, nothing. You're cut off if you continue. And Turkey, cut off the oil. But they don't do that. And so what's going to happen is Israel is going to continue to do what it wants to do. And it will ultimately end up making a terrible miscalculation. And I think it will end up destroying itself over this. I think it's very, very, very possible. So that's the danger of it. Because once these wars, you go back in history, And, you know, like Japanese expected, oh, boy, we'll knock those Americans out of Pearl Harbor. Well, it'll be a short war. World War One, the war to end all wars. We're gonna, going over there. It's going to be done in a month. American Civil War, same thing. They thought it would be over after one battle. Well, shock and awe going into Iraq, 2003. Oh, man, you know, we had Bush, you know, with mission accomplished. Yeah, that was May. And then, you know, 8 years later, you're still getting Americans killed on the ground. So this concept that you can use military force and you're going to get a rapid, quick outcome. It's like even if Iran, strikes back and hits Israel and hurts Israel significantly, it's not going to end the Israeli military threat because they'll retaliate with nukes probably. And then if they hit Iran with some nukes, it's not going to destroy Iran. Iran's too big and too mountainous. But that's going to bring in China and Russia. And then all of a sudden, you know, what's the United States going to do? You know, so this thing can escalate real quick and get out of control, where everyone's feel that they've got to react and not have a clear solution in mind.
The other thing, Larry, is people are now most of the people, Zionists in the United States, they're talking about if Trump was in power, he would do something different and he would bring. But at the end of the day, we know the foreign policy of the United States in the Middle East is not the way that going to work for peace in that region. That's why we are having a lot of tensions in the Middle East between Israel and these right now Turkey, Arab states.
Well, Trump, I believe, would his ultimate policy might not necessarily be different from Biden's, but how he gets there would, and part of getting there would be talking. He would be talking to people. He would be talking to Putin. He'd be talking to Xi Jinping. He'd even be talking to the new Iranian president. And so that is the one good thing that would separate Trump from Biden, the willingness to actually talk and engage these people without saying that we're not going to talk and all we're going to do is either impose sanctions on you or go to war with you. You know, that's not the how you go about winning friends and influencing enemies. So, you know, I think on that front, we would see a difference with Trump. But policy-wise, in terms of support for Israel, no. He'd probably actually be a more ardent supporter of Israel. And I'm not sure if that would work to his advantage or disadvantage in negotiations with, say, Iran.
I personally don't believe that Trump is looking after any sort of war in the Middle East because he's not interested in any sort of war. He showed us in his first term.
Yeah. If it was just Trump making that decision, but it's not. He was bullied into bombing Syria after a staged chemical weapons attack that was blamed on the Syrian government. And it wasn't not done by the Syrian government. It was basically a CIA MI6 intelligence operation. If Trump was just by himself, yeah, his inclination would be, hey, let's talk, let's make a deal. Not going to fight.
Yeah. And Larry, you wrote a piece last night on your website, Sonar 21. It says, the title is Iran a major sponsor of terrorism? And could you elaborate on this article? I found it so interesting.
Yeah, well, when you listen to the rhetoric out of the United States, you know, Iran's the major sponsor of terrorism in the world. I said, oh, really? Well, please give me the list of those terrorist attacks that Iran has been behind and is supporting. And so when you put it in those terms, say, let's actually count it up, you find that the Iran of the 21st century is not the Iran of the 20th century in terms of terrorism. Right after the, you know, after the takeover of by the Ayatollah Khomeini and the rise of the Iranian Revolution, in the early days, yes, Iran was using attacks against U.S. diplomatic and military facilities with people not wearing uniforms. It was asymmetrical warfare. They didn't just attack us because they hated our freedom. You know, we've heard that, oh, they hate our freedom, or because they thought that we were the great Satan. Part of the reason they thought we were the great Satan was because we had enabled the Shah of Iran for so many years. And so the number of people had been tortured and abused under the Shah. They tended to blame the United States for having made that possible. But in the 1980s, you had Imad Mughniyeh, who is a Lebanese Muslim, but he was closely aligned with the Iranians and became sort of, he was what I call him, he was bin Laden before there was bin Laden, as far as being a terrorist mastermind. Blew up the U.S. Embassy in 1983 in Beirut, then the Marine encampment near the airport in November of 83. Then the embassy annex was blown up in Beirut the next year. Bunch of Americans from the CIA chief of station, a bunch of Americans were kidnapped, including CIA chief of station Bill Buckley, Rich Higgins, Colonel Bill Higgins, but he's known as Rich, Terry Anderson, who was a reporter, perceived to be as an intelligence agent, Reverend Terry Waite, Joseph Sosipia, I always remember that name. Yeah, just a bunch of Americans that were presumed to be either assets or acting on behalf of the CIA, or they were seen as potential bargaining chips that could be traded for Iranians that were being held. So there was a lot of terrorism in the 1980s. Well, not in the 21st century. The most of the evidence for Iran's involvement in, quote, terrorism is that Iran is supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. Hamas and Hezbollah are not puppets of Iran by any stretch. They're their own entities. But yeah, they've had direct support from Iran. But as you know, we talked, you know, a couple of weeks ago about the actual statistics on Hamas. Hamas is not a major terrorist outfit, and Hamas is not really engaged with international terrorism. They're engaged with, they're a religious band of people who think that Israel has stolen their land, and they're going to fight Israel to get their land back, and they will kill anybody who gets in their way to stop them. Now, we call that, you know, in our the comfort of being the state power, we get to call that terrorism. Now, when we, the United States, arms some group like the Mujahideen al-Haq that we talked about to carry out attacks against Iranian government figures, that's okay. That's not terrorism. So see, terrorism is a very useful tool that you can use it as a pejorative. But the reality is Iran has been actually fighting against the Sunni extremists that have been the major source of terrorism in the 21st century. If by terrorism you refer to attacks that are carried out against state actors and their citizens for the purpose of intimidating, destroying, and forcing them to change their policy. That's what ISIS was all about, to initially force the United States out of Iraq. But then it had a broader mission of basically establishing Islam as a global caliphate. Well, that's quite different. You know, that's not Iran by any stretch. Excuse me.
Yeah. Larry, the other thing right now is the assassination of Haniyeh. Do we know what has happened really? Because New York Times was publishing an article saying something different from what Iranians are talking about. What's your take on this?
Yeah, the concept that it was either an Israeli plane flew a missile and then launched the missile. I know there are some precision missiles, but I'm not sure there's one that precise that can do that. It sounds like it was an inside job. Somebody, even within the Iranian intelligence service, may have betrayed Haniyeh. There are lots of possibilities. We talked about the MEK, the MEK. They could have done it. You've got the Baluchis, ethnic group that's in southeastern Iran along the Pakistan-Afghan border. The Baluchis are, they got a presence in Tehran. They've got a long history with the CIA and with Israel. And then the other thing not to forget is you had these Israeli intelligence officers that were meeting regularly with Iranian counterparts 40 years ago. You develop relationships, stay in touch. Those people had children, grandchildren. I'm saying there are a lot of ways that the Israelis could reach into that society, and they did. It's almost as like it doesn't matter how they killed him or why they killed him. The fact that they killed him is the issue, because it's now put Iran in a position that they need to retaliate.
Yeah. Israelis have assassinated the political leader and military leader of Hamas so far. And would that change the game in favor of Israel?
No. Oh, absolutely. It's going to probably do just the opposite. It will create somebody who is perhaps more opposed to Israel, more strident, more anti-Israeli than, say, Haniyeh was. Which is, we've seen this sort of throughout history that sometimes when you kill the leader, you can not wind up with a bigger extremist in charge in their heels. So there's no guarantee that by killing them, you're going to get a better solution.
Yeah. And on the other hand, Larry, right now, do you think that Washington, if something big happens between Iran and Israel, how far Washington is able to risk a conflict, a bigger conflict with Iran?
Oh, I think quite high. I think that's one of the reasons you've got the commander of, Central Command over there. Central Command is based here in Tampa, Florida, at MacDill Air Force Base, just north of me. Excuse me. But he's now over in Bahrain at the headquarters of the 5th Fleet, the U.S. 5th Fleet. So the 5th Fleet has got responsibility for the Middle East. He's over there for a reason. There have been other combat aircraft have been flown in, F-35s, reportedly some B-2 bombers as well. I've seen contradictory reports on that, some saying yay, some say nay. But if the B-2's there, again, that's a bomber capable of carrying a very heavy payload. That could mean that the United States would be prepared to carry out airstrikes inside Iran, which then means another reason for why the Russians are visiting. Maybe they're bringing and getting an agreement to bring in Russian air defense systems, manned and staffed by trained Russians, because they may not have, they don't have the time to train the Iranians, a lot of moving pieces here.
Yeah, but it's so amazing, Larry, right now, how this. Do you think that Russia is trying to convince Iran not to escalate the tensions, or they're trying to help Iran militarily? What is the main goal on the part of Russians?
I think the Russians are probably trying to counsel the Iranians into being cautious and to make sure that whatever they do, that they got a follow-on plan. They're just not going to lash out, hit Israel and say, there, we punched you back. Well, then what happens if Israel chooses to punch back, only with nukes? Then what? So I think Russia's walking Iran through the thought process of, yeah, if you're going to react in this way, Israel's likely to react in that way, and then they react, it's going to leave you with, you know, this could escalate, you know, beyond the control of either Israel or Iran, and end up bringing the United States, Russia, China into the war, which would be a truly global war and would likely involve the use of nuclear weapons on all sides, which is just a horrific nightmare.
Yeah. And the other thing, Larry, would be the role of China right now and how China perceives this conflict in the Middle East, what they're trying to do in your opinion, what's in their mind right now?
Well, they recognize Israel's out of control. Remember the other day when Iran requested that the Security Council be convened to discuss the attack, the assassination of Haniyeh. And it was at China also supported that request. So China, again, China and Russia are supporting Iran in this. They're in Iran's corner, and they've been in Iran's corner in terms of doing joint military exercises. And from a perspective, is Iran's requested to be a member of BRICS as well. So, and from a geopolitical position, Iran is a very important country. Can't be ignored. It's just by where it sits. You have to take it seriously.
Yeah. And shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, how do you find it right now? Do you think that we are focusing too much in the Middle East that nobody seems to care, even in the United States, what's going on in Ukraine?
Yeah, go, Ukraine? What? Something going on there? You know, it's like, yeah, what's remarkable is the pace of the Russian offensive, let's call it what it is, has accelerated over the last 3 weeks. So they're taking it. You know, before they'd fight for 4 months, 6 months, 8 months to take a city, a village. Now they're taking one a day, one or two a day. And it looks like they're going to, you know, pretty quick, you know, perhaps as soon as the end of September, have full control of, have completely pushed the Ukrainians out of the Donbas. So that's what I mean when it's moving quick. And there are a lot of things running against the Ukrainians. So they need to recruit about 30,000 new people a month. And they say they're doing that. I'm skeptical. But then there are also reports that there are at least 5,000 desertions a month. So if you need to recruit 30 and 5,000 of them are running off, then you're missing the mark by 5,000 a month. And you're so over. So the point is that the morale in Ukraine is starting to break. And break in a way that they are recognizing they have no hope of winning this war. And it's starting to question, is the government trying to get them all killed?
Yeah. Do you think that 2024 would be the last year of this conflict in Ukraine?
It could be the end of this major military push by Russia. But it's not going to end the possibility of what I'd call terrorist insurgent attacks. I think that would still go on for a while. But it's nothing that's going to be of such severity that it'll prevent Russia from, you know, bringing those new republics fully into the Russian Federation.
It seems that the United States right now with the conflict in the Middle East has a very serious problem, because Russia says that if you're going to continue supporting Ukraine, we're going to support each and every group in the Middle East to fight back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look at the relative positions of how the roles have reversed for the United States and Russia. 10 years ago, the United States was riding pretty high. You know, the United States, we controlled the dollar was king. Our economy is the biggest, strongest. And we were seen as a major player in world affairs. Now, what's happened is with the emergence of BRICS, real questions are being raised about, is the United States even a reliable economic ally anymore? Let's not even talk about politics. And then the fact that despite all the U.S. assistance to Ukraine, it's not prevailing in the war against Russia. It's losing badly. So, you know, all of that comes up against then the United States with its limited power is growing increasingly angry at other countries where we're trying to slap sanctions on them, like, you know, India. And we have the, you know, America's gotten the habit of going out and lecturing other people about election integrity and democracy and freedom. And it's just, you know, the rest of the world just start looking and say, who are you to talk to us? I mean, you can't even figure out what your voting machines work. You know, it took you 2 weeks to figure out if Donald Trump had actually been elected. So it's just, you know, the United States position is weakening. The position of Russia and China is strengthening, and particularly in the Middle East.
Yeah, that's why I think that there is a crucial need for have some sort of communication between Russia, China, and the United States. Because as you've mentioned, in the Middle East, without the United States, if Russia, China, India all together breaks, they cannot bring some sort of sanity to the Middle East. Because right. Israel just... they don't consider any of these countries but the United States. And in Ukraine as well, they have to communicate with each other.
Yeah, you know, you're too young to remember, but back in the 1970s, so and, you know, we're coming out of the Vietnam War, and in that Vietnam War, the Russians had been fully backing the North Vietnamese, arming them, helping them, even flying planes. They were doing some of the things that we think Americans are doing now with the Ukrainians. And yet out of all of that, the United States was still able to talk president to president to then Soviets. So Nixon talked to the Soviets and, you know, Leonid Brezhnev as an example. Then, you know, Gerald Ford when he was briefly president, and Jimmy Carter. And there was a recognition that we need to talk. We need to find a common ground that we're not going to kill each other. And these were communists, for God's sake. Well, Putin's not a communist. He's not a Nazi. He's a strong nationalist, and he's a Christian to boot. All the more reason we should be talking to him. But no, there is no discussion. And that's what makes all this so dangerous, the refusal to talk.
Yeah. Larry, just to wrap up this session, right now we are witnessing some sort of tensions, some sort of civil wars in the United Kingdom. Do we know what's going on there right now with the conflict, considering the conflict in the Middle East, just... everything is getting out of the hand in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, well, you know, they've been flooded with illegal immigrants. The immigrants that are coming in don't necessarily speak English. They're not of, you know, they don't come out of an English culture or tradition. And it's changing England, changing the face of England. Now, it certainly changes the face of London, you know. London, which, you know, sort of popularized with Mary Poppins, you know, the basically white people, you know, Caucasians, not that many people out of who are black. That used to be the image. Now, I mean, there are sections of London, just if you walk up out of Hyde Park, that for an entire, you know, about a mile and a half, you think you're in Cairo or Marrakesh, or it's just, you know, or Beirut, but in one of the souks in Beirut or in Ishtar. I mean, it's just, it's heavily Muslim. With that, you know, they'll even slaughter goats out on the sidewalk, you know, for Eid. I mean, it's just, it's culture shock. It's not England. It's not with Shakespeare and Churchill. It's something not, it's like out of an English colonial period, only a colonial property that the Brits ruled over. So, yeah, they're losing that control, and it's deepening the political rift in the UK. Starmer is already, his popularity has already dropped 16 points. And he wasn't like he was an overwhelming, they didn't vote for him because they liked him. They voted, the Brits that voted for him, a large number of them did so because they just hated Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives so much. Which is, you know, it's not a really good position to be in, to say, hey, I hate this other guy so much, I'm voting for you, holding my nose. That's not strong support.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us. The great pleasure as always.
All right. Let's hope we're here at the end of the week.
Yeah. Yeah. See you soon.
All right, my friend. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.